Hello, everybody. Welcome to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli today, and we're going to be talking about nanomaterials. Nanomaterials are ubiquitous these days. You find them everywhere because we put them in many products that society uses. But the trouble with that is that they get out of where we put them into other locations. They get into plants. They get into all sorts of, they get into the water, I suppose. And so, Russ, how are we going to deal with this problem? And who's our guest today?
Well, we're very happy to have with us today on Science Studio, Dr. Aram Castillo-Michel. And he's at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. And he came from Mexico to UTEP to France. And a synchrotron, by the way, we're going to learn more about it, is just a big ring with a tunable X-ray source, and you can do all kinds of experiments on it. Welcome to Science Studio, Aram.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be back in my institute.
Home.
My home still. And I'm very happy. Thanks for the invitation.
Tell us, you're from Chihuahua, Mexico.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did you get to UTEP?
After I did my bachelor's, I was looking for something to do, right? And then I learned about the master's program in here in UTEP. I came for interview with professors, mainly Dr. Gardea. And then I decided to apply, and I got into the master's program in chemistry. And then when I finished this, then I wanted to do PhD, so I stayed at the environmental science and engineering program for another few years.
Just before we get into the synchrotron and its use for analysis and nanomaterials, what was the sort of driving force when you were young? We like to know this from our guests. When you were a little boy, I mean, did you, when you were 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, whatever the age was, when did you suddenly think science?
I think that it was not so young, when I was so young. It was when I was probably in middle school that I realized that rather than being looking at these social classes, I was more into doing math and physics and chemistry, and I could spend more time solving a problem in physics or balancing an equation in chemistry than going in reading about history. And it's still important, and I went through all these classes, but there was more in the science and the engineering side, and it was always like this. When I was younger, I could say that it was the same for me to go in math or social studies, but then in middle school, I realized that I had more tendency to go towards this, and then this is how I got more into science. And
we're trying today to figure out ways, how do we get young people interested in science like we used to?
I think that when you teach science, you have to relate, and it's probably done, but it should be more stressed. You have to relate with real cases, right? You don't have to teach so abstract concepts, but really relate them to the real scenario and show them how is it that you use science, engineering, math in real life, right? And sometimes you're learning only all these abstract concepts in mathematics, and until you realize how you can apply them in real life, it's when you say, how interesting this is. And it's done, but probably should be stressed.
It's interesting you say that, because Russ and I have, they're not diametrically opposed ideas. We have 90% of our ideas are the same, like our genetic makeup probably. But the bottom line is there's this little tension that in terms of research, you know, Russ is saying, well, if it doesn't have any social applicability, why are you doing it? On the other hand, I say, well, if that was the sort of the norm, you know, nobody would make this sort of off-the-cuff unexpected discoveries, right? Aiming always at a focus, I don't find that so entertaining. I like to just to let the science take me where I want to go. Maybe there's a use down the road. But
it's theory to application versus stuck in the ivory tower. Mm.
And the ivory tower is a wonderful place to be. They sometimes have princesses on the top floor. Anyway, let's get on to the...
Well, let me just mention one thing, which is about the education of young. You know, I have some grandsons when they're in the fourth grade, and I worked on bioremediation. I said, you go down to the river, you take some water, the hydrocarbon degrading organisms are in the water, put some Wesson oil on one, on both of them, and put garden fertilizer in one and watch them. and they learn and they won a prize for a science project. And it's like, go down to the river. They're everywhere. Everybody can do this.
And they probably don't realize that they're doing a scientific experiment.
No, that sounds like fun. Really.
Exactly.
And that is one of the issues of getting the fun back into laboratory sequences. Yeah. I mean, since we're on the topic, there's a nutty idea that's going around that says now we should be doing undergraduate laboratories, but virtual laboratories.
Oh.
You know, going online to do the laboratories. Now, for me, Keith Pannell, that is just anathema. It just doesn't do it. But universities, certain faculty people, certain companies that make programs specifically to make money out of virtual laboratories say, but you're saving money. But you've lost a whole generation of people who touch
and
feel.
See, in another 20 years, there won't be any airline pilots or professors. Well, it'll all be computers.
Absolutely. Right. So I'm getting out before then. I got another 15 years.
I think that the use of technology, social media and technology, virtual sources, it's important. You can learn many things from a class which is recorded on YouTube, for example, but you should not forget that you should go in the classroom and interact with the professor and do things your own. And I've done it. I've followed classes even now as a PhD and with the job I do. When I don't know how to do things, I try to go on YouTube or some video online, and then I get to see how things are done, and this is good. But at the same time, you should not go on one side or the other. You should, you know, benefit from both, I think. So,
okay, let's get to the rub of the nub of the program.
Back to the synchrotron.
Yeah, what do you do?
So I work at this beamline. So synchrotrons have many stations, and they're called beamlines. And this beamline, it's a microspectroscopy beamline. So we use X-rays and infrared radiation to probe samples, different kind of samples. My applications is mainly biological samples and analyzing elements that are part of these nanomaterials, nanoparticles. So we use a small X-ray beam, 600 nanometer. We raster scan samples. We get elemental distribution from them.
Then so you can read the elements with the beam as you scan and you get a pattern.
Yeah, this is the X-ray.
And there was one example, the guy at Stanford that read the ancient Greek manuscript that was under a painting.
Yeah, this is cultural heritage is an area or research area that is taking advantage of these synchrotron techniques. X-ray fluorescence is with laboratory sources and synchrotron sources is used a lot by people from the whole cultural heritage to analyze kind of art.
So
objects.
In a sense, boy, it's non-destructive. I mean, it's got to be destructive at that very nanoparticle level to a certain extent. But, I mean, so it's a good way to distinguish forgeries, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, I just recently was this art dealer in New York that was found guilty of fellow went to jail forging all sorts of wines and paintings. So this technique, in a sense, could be very expensive technique to prove the
truth. I mean, it's normally used for the sunflower painting from Van Gogh. It was degrading, right? And they took a small sample from it without destroying. This small sample was analyzed, and at the surface they realized that chromium-6 was being reduced to chromium-3. And that there is all sort of organic material in there, binders and things that they use for painting, which was like the reason why it was getting degraded. And now they are trying to preserve it, right? To stop this process of reduction so that the sunflowers do not become completely brown after a few years. Right. So this is one example, not in my area, but you know, synchrotron
techniques
you can
apply.
It's so wonderful.
So you're applying this technique to looking at the metals that are in plant parts, roots, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Please tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so you expose a plant in soil or in a hydroponic media to nanomaterial, nanoparticles normally, cerium oxide or silver nanoparticles, and then after some time, then you want to know whether they go in. And you can use some destructive techniques to learn the concentration, but the problem is that you don't really know where they are. And in order to know how they are moving. You have to know where they are, where they are being stored, how they are transported. But moreover, not only the localization, but also what is the chemistry of these nanomaterials. Why? Because if you put zinc oxide, then we have seen that after exposure to the plant, it's no longer zinc oxide. It's zinc plus two, which is coordinated to some other organic acid, and it's moving along the plant. So the plant is like taking these zinc oxide nanoparticles as a source of zinc. If you put cerium oxide, they do not dissolve. And as cerium oxide, they are moving to all parts of the plant. So we've seen cerium oxide located in roots in the transport system of the plant.
For our audience, let me, the root, you know, there's metals around, okay? And we had an example, too, where the root has some chemistry that can keep a toxic metal out, but some other metal, it doesn't know when it comes in.
What we have seen is that if the metal, which is part of this nanoparticle, is some sort of nutrient to the plant has already built-in mechanisms to access these elements, right? So they normally would dissolve and become ionic species and move along, right? But if it's something rather inert and has no benefit to the plant, it would stay in the same. So cerium oxide, titanium dioxide, they stay in the same form as oxides, which are rather insoluble and difficult to dissolve. But if you put zinc oxide, silver nanoparticles, they tend to dissolve, they release ions, and this could be benefit or could be toxic. It depends on how the plant is handling this extra source of...
So you mentioned cerium oxide nanoparticles. I think you said that they also, though, move around and migrate, or no?
Yes.
So how does that process work? Because, you know, that's a little nanoparticle of what you're calling an inert material. And so it moves in bulk, or does it just move little by little and a seed occurs and then another one? I mean, that's a very entertaining sort of idea. How does it work?
This is what we are trying to understand, right? There should be some interaction, some coating with all organic, small proteins, organic acids that should probably interact with the surface of these particles and then guide them through the plant, right? Maybe reaching inside cells or maybe just going around the cells until they reach the transport system of a plant, and then they go up. And then the plant, if it feels some sort of toxicity, then they would tend to put them in some place. For instance, trichomes, which are hairs from the leaves, they tend to accumulate a lot of these exogenous materials, right? If you put a lot of chromium, you will find chromium in the trichomes. If you put a lot of titanium dioxide, it would go in the trichomes as well.
I don't know this word.
Trichome.
Yeah, but what is it?
It's a hair. It's you know, these tiny hairs
like
that you see in
cell
leaves.
With an opening on the leaf.
There are some glandular trichomes which release things that the plant do not want, and there is some others that are kind of just for defense. But this is basically a tiny hair on the leaf surface.
Almost on the outside of the plant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They take it's it like from a, wherever it is.
It's like an organ of the plant where they release.
It's like
release
an outhouse, right? I mean, that's about as good as I can think. Well, talking about outhouses, it's time for a timeout. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pennell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli and Dr. Iram Castillo-Michel from the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in Grenoble?
Yes.
We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you're tempted to make a dumb blonde joke, don't, because they're obsolete.
Turns out, blonde hair is determined by a single letter in the 3 billion letters of the human genetic code and affects no other trait. Not intelligence, nor the capacity for fun.
This discovery came from studies on sticklebacks, a small fish in various habitats around the world, each group having evolved its own distinct skin color.
A gene called the KIT ligand is responsible for the fish's skin pigment, which in an earlier study, scientists found also affects skin color in humans, and possibly hair color too.
However, KIT ligand plays other important roles in humans, affecting blood cells and sperm cells. It's actually a mutation in an area affecting the KIT ligand that causes blonde hair in northern Europeans.
So how did evolutionary changes occur without affecting KIT ligand's other important functions? Researchers in a new study decided to isolate this regulatory element and determine how it was different in blondes.
Using engineered mice, they were able to identify a single letter change from A to G that creates blondes while affecting nothing else. This isn't turning a gene on or off, but rather it shows how a gene can be used slightly differently in just one part of the body.
Subtle changes like this one reveal how exquisitely controlled the utilization of genes is regulated and how changes to the system contributes to human diversity.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chiodelli, lots of pieces of paper, and Iram Castillo-Michel from the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. We're talking about the use of this European Synchrotron Facility to study nanoparticles in places where they shouldn't be and where they can be deleterious to our health, for example. So that's the big picture. What are we finding, Iram? I mean, are these nanoparticles that are being used widely around, are they in fact in danger of being sort of regulated more seriously because they're landing up in places that we don't want them to be?
Yes, there are several applications, and yes, they are moving in getting into parts where you would not want them to be. With the plant studies we've done, we found, for example, that soybean grains are accumulating extra cerium oxide when they are exposed to these cerium oxide nanoparticles in the soil. It's also reducing the amount of nitrogen that is fixated by the plants, which is an important environmental service.
Right? Cerium oxide inhibits the nitrogen fixation plants.
It will depend a lot, and this is the problem. These nanomaterials are difficult to characterize. That's why synchrotrons are an important technique, and it's moving more towards nanoanalysis, so smaller beams, and to be able to more in detail characterize these materials, because it's difficult. The thing is, like, their functioning, whether it's good or bad, will depend on the size, the geometry, the crystallinity, the surface charge, all these physical, chemical characteristics. And then if you don't know what it is at the beginning, it's difficult to know how it's going to interact. And so there is a lot of problem, you know, characterizing the materials when you start doing an experiment. And then as it moves, then it starts becoming something else at the same time. So it's one of the problems, right? We don't have, or that's my opinion, we don't have all the tools to look at these materials.
So, for example, going back to the cerium oxide and nitrogen fixation, so the ability of these small nanoparticles, this cerium oxide, to inhibit nitrogen fixation depends upon the size of the nanoparticle and the geometric structure, as you put it, the crystalline form. So sometimes it does inhibit and other times it does not.
Yeah. For example, cerium oxide, it's normally cerium plus 4, right?
Yes.
But you know that as the material is, well, there is always in the bulk, you will have this external layer, which has different chemistry. If it's a bulk material, then the contribution of this surface is small. But if you make it smaller, 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 then the surface, there is more
the surface
contact, and the
dominates.
Surface chemistry is more important.
Yeah.
And at the surface, you have different cerium 3 and cerium 4. You have cerium 3, cerium 4 ratios, right? And this, of course, it donates electrons or receives electrons, and this will have either the possibility to prevent oxidative stress in a cell, for example, or to induce oxidative stress in a cell. And if you don't characterize these at this level, you know, if you don't have the sensitivity to say what's the ratio cerium 3, cerium 4 in this cerium oxide, which is still a crystalline small particle, if you don't know these, then it's difficult for you to say, and then you tend to interpret results based on your experiment. But this is one of the parts on cerium oxide, this is one of the problematic, and there is some nice technique where you can do that.
How does the cerium get into the crops? Why?
Well, the thing is, like, these materials are used for instance, for polishing windows. You know, it's so nice because it's a abrasive.
Abrasive, right.
Yeah. So you put them in these sprays, and then you clean your windows, and they're nice, shiny, but you put nanoparticles, and then at the end, where they go? This is just one example I can give you. Of course, there should be many other applications, but you can see this is one
so
of
So if your house is dirty and you don't clean your windows, you're healthier.
Well, I mean, that reminds me, in centuries ago, when windows certainly became, you know, glass windows became in vogue, all right, there was a window tax in Britain. You know, the more windows you had, the more tax you had to pay.
Oh, really?
All right, and so, you know, maybe we should be thinking about this business, right? But anyway, so I didn't realize cerium oxide was that prevalent, and it's simply to get cleaner windows.
Yeah.
Where's the old chamois leather gone, right? Just a bit of soap and chamois leather.
Well, I don't mean to say that all the products that you use for cleaning windows will right? But the thing is, like regulations, they don't force you now to disclaim there is nanomaterials.
Probably, up to my knowledge, auto polishes too.
Yeah. And then, for instance, silver nanoparticles, we have a nice study we've done. There is a dressing that you use to heal severe burns. So this was a human sample. My colleagues grabbed biopsies from a person who was injured over the entire treatment. And then we see that when the wound is releasing, so this is a material which is coated with silver nanoparticles, 10 nanometer. And when the wound is releasing more liquids and there's more inflammation, you have a lot of release of particles, and they precipitate, so it's ions, and they precipitate as chloride on the surface rather where the epidermis should be, but it's not present because you have a wound. And then after, on the 12th day, there is no more deposit of silver chloride. Everything has moved away, which means that all these ions are released and your body is taking them in some other place. And we don't have studies to see where they went, right? Whether you are eliminating or they go and locate in some other part of your body. But there is a lot of release. Of course, it serves its purpose. It helps healing the person. But at the same time, it's a big intake of silver, which is not probably so good.
It's just the old adage. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. You know, it gets transformed, you know, and it doesn't just disappear just because you don't see it. Do you do much of work in terms of people, organs, and tissue apart from that? I mean, you're talking about plants, but does that relate then to people and human samples?
So human samples, what I have done, of course, other colleagues at the Beamline have done other experiments with human samples, but we have done this experiment with the human skin and the treatment with this silver. But in our Beamline, we have done this experiment with the human skin, and also I have a colleague who is investigating the interaction of immune cells. So these are neutrophils extracted from humans that are working in the department. And then he exposes these neutrophils to titanium dioxide nanoparticles, and then we look for them, where they are, whether they go inside the cells or not. And with some infrared light, we also try to understand biochemically what is happening. So this is another kind of human samples. My colleague is interested on the release of metallic nano and microparticles from titanium implants, because sometimes they get rejected, sometimes they not. So there is an interaction between your immune system and the quality of the implant that will define whether you reject it or accept it. And this is what he wants to understand. And
let me ask after the question, going back to the trichromes and the vacuoles, you know. Some plants say this is bad, and they put in vacuole and it just sits there, okay? And that you can talk about phytomining and things like that. But other ones, like we've studied, when it goes through the trichrome, they'll grow crystals out on the leaf.
Yeah.
So how does it choose between throwing it out, growing crystals, storing it over there in a vacuole?
Oh, that's a great question.
Because I know that there was a woman that was saying, now this was some kind of algae, but where there was uranium in the waters, this was like where they were working with it, the algae, you just put it in a vacuole, no problem.
I would say that in the vacuole you could put things that can be coordinated to some tile groups mainly. I don't want to make this a general statement, but we've seen...
So what you're saying is that the chemistry within the vacuole will be different from the one in these trichomes, what are they?
Yeah, the trichomes are normally more
crystalline.
Thing. It's like they exudate these sap or these liquid, right? And it has so heavy concentration of metals that when it comes in air, it dries and it leaves small crystals, right? Precipitates. And some groups have analyzed these with micro X-ray diffraction and other techniques, and they have found really interesting results. Hey,
one of the things I lay out here, too, is that I was just in a meeting in Cancun, by the way. They were actually using plants to create nanomaterials. You know, let's use the plant and we can synthesize all these small particles that we really want.
This is a really interesting topic, actually. One application that comes to mind is, or particular case, is silver. Again, if you put silver nanoparticles, you will see that there is release of ions, and so you find in several places, you find a combination of the metallic elemental silver and some ionic species normally bound to sulfur, sometimes oxygen as well. But if you put ionic species, you find pretty much the same thing, which means that if you put an ionic species, it goes inside, and in some particular place of the plant, it will create, the environment will be the correct one so that it gets reduced into elemental sulfur, and from there, I think it keeps moving, just, you know, changing from elemental sulfur to ionic, and it goes all over the place.
Well, so it's a dynamic equilibrium. Once you enter it, in the end, everything forms up in the same sort of relative amounts. We've only got a few minutes left yet, but what are you doing right now? What is really hot on your agenda right at this moment?
We are looking at the transfer of these particles in the food chain, so experiments are getting complicated. Now we are trying to analyze worms or mantis, you know, insects that are chewing on the plants. In environmental science, this is the hot topic, right? The transferring to the food chain.
Right.
Not only analyzing the plant, but seeing what's happening after one insect or something eats on these. And
are you finding that, in fact, the nanoparticles
this
are
is
being
where
transformed?
We are starting on that, actually.
So you don't have any results yet?
For the moment, no.
I mean, because it reminds me of this recent work that was published up in Wisconsin, I think, on prions. You know, the prions have been now discovered to be in plant materials, all right? And so sooner or later, you know, you're gonna, if it's wheat, well, you know, do you have prions on your bread? You know, I mean, people are going to get paranoid, but not yet. You've been listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I was here with Russ Chianelli, and our guest today was from the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in Grenoble, France, Iram Castillo-Michel, an ex-student of the University of Texas at El Paso, and having a wonderful career over there looking at nanoparticles, where they go, how do they transform, and of course, in the end, do we eat them, I suppose. That's the logic here. So that's it, folks. You've listened to another Science Studio program. We will be back next week with another program, so keep listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. El Paso's LGBT community has a new two-story site on West Yandell called the Outright Center. It will include a pharmacy and medical exam rooms. There will also be a fitness room and social activities for gay youth. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred, a transitional care hospital.